This is really a roundtable and a discussion. It is not a, you know, it is not a formal lecture. I'm Lira Auslander. I teach at the University of Chicago. I do stuff. So the idea of this, for those of you who were at the Western last year, we did a big plenary around the material culture and using material culture, both for research purposes and teaching purposes. And this is the kind of the follow up on that. Because there was a lot of interest in both sides of the question, that is, how to use things, material culture, effectively in the classroom, and what kind of research questions can one tackle through material culture or conventional questions that can be for which material culture provides a different kind of evidence. So my scheme was to talk a little about material culture and the way I'm using the term. I have a bunch of stuff here, as you'll see, that some of which can circulate, some of which is a little too fragile to circulate. I also have many images of all kinds of objects that that are not in my possession or are not portable. I'd like it if fairly early in our session to get a sense of your interest in this, because and I'll very quickly show you my I'll scoot back to some of these, but the array of images range from a set of French Revolution images to 19th-20th century interiors. Oops, that one was misplaced. To things of French Jewish life, a variety of kinds, and on to racialized images and colonial and imperial history. So we can. I have way too much with me for us to actually talk about, and so I'd like to draw on what interests you as we go along. So just to back up and start at the beginning, I'm sure there's a more efficient way of doing this. There we go. The first and obvious question is, what is material culture and how is it useful? And I don't want to bore those of you who have already thought about this, but I think a few definitions are useful. And also, I think everybody who works with material culture has their own idiosyncratic, but hopefully rather precise definition of what they're doing. Because I, for example, do not deal with functional objects in the work I do, which is not because I think functional objects are not important at all or not revelatory. It's for the set of questions that most interest me, they're not that useful. That is, things like axles and ball bearings, the two examples you have there, their form is determined by their function. And they can be profoundly aesthetic objects. I chose these slides partially because they're beautiful. So this isn't an argument that these things are ugly or that they're not interesting to look at or they're not, I could go on at some length about precisely what you can learn historically from this set of ball bearings, because they replace something called the Babbitt bearing, and which had to be individually poured, and if the difference between having industrial produced ball bearings versus artisanal ramifications for industrialization. So there are important, really important stories that can be told from functional objects. My own preoccupation is much more with communication and affect and symbolic practices, so for those questions this is less useful. I would say these are still material objects of material culture, just ones that I'm not including in my purview. Does anybody have anything of interest that they are any curiosities about functional objects or anything that they that any dwelling on that? Mm-hmm. No? Okay. There are also a set of objects that are functional and simultaneously sometimes aestheticized, but where function really takes precedence. I mean, I would argue in the question of ball bearings and axles, the people designing them are not thinking about the aesthetics of them. It's simply not a preoccupation. When somebody's thinking about a roasting pan, they're primarily worrying about how you will roast your turkey or whatever it is, an effective pan to roast that turkey in. But nonetheless, there's a particular curve to that handle that has nothing to do with function. That has a lot to do with an aesthetics of design, the particular curve of it, and even, I would argue, scalpels, if you look at those designs, that there are aspects of them that have been aestheticized, or in the question of fuselages. But where, in the end, what's going to take precedence is going to have to be, will it get the job done or will it not? Again, I don't deal primarily with objects of that class. This is a very different set and part of why I wanted to have these up here and around is, you know, most of the objects I've brought here today and most of what one, though not all of them, are, and most of what I've worked on and I think people think about in material culture is artisanal or individually designed things, and that I don't think that the class should be in any way limited to that, and industrial design is for the 20th century and 21st century utterly fundamental. And the Coke bottle, for example, yeah, sure, there's a function; it has to carry liquid, but the design has very little to do with the function at that point. So these are a class of objects that I think can be very well thought about in terms of communication, expression, even affect. And likewise, and then I have a particular preoccupation with things that touch the body, because I think that, or things in contact with the body as opposed to things at a distance from it, partially because I think there's a particular charge to those, an affective charge, a psychological charge, and the aestheticization of them takes a course that's different from some others. So I brought some, actually, from a French context. So... any idea? What do you have to have for this thing to be of any use? Okay, yeah, you gotta have substantial. Any idea what it's made of?
Tortoise.
Yeah. So this is, and where do tortoises come from? Yeah. Right. Well, yeah. Some tropical, some. And anybody know anything about the qualities of tortoise shell? What it's. Yeah, and it's pretty pliable, and it can be translucent. Yeah, so you can, and so you need a lot of hair. Any idea of what shape? No, I have a lot of hair, but that's not. I mean, I could, but it's not going to stay. It's not going to stay put. So, what's the hair? What have you done to your hair? Yeah. What do you think about the? Yeah. So it's rather carefully designed to fit that purpose. If you came across this, what would you read from it about gender, about hair? Yeah. Yeah, you should use a mic, I think, and identify yourself, right?
What number is that one?
Six.
Right, in which case it's not.
It's an object.
All right.
I'm Julia Landweber, Montclair State University, New Jersey. So let's see, going back to the question that Leora asked, I would think something about women, perhaps of a middle class, reasonably, a woman with leisure enough to put the time into doing a rather elegant updo. If I knew more about when it was made, I might have more opinions about who this woman might particularly be.
Yeah. Any idea about how you figure out when it was made? Catalogs.
Yeah.
If you look at catalogs, it's from the 1880s almost certainly. But I found it in a flea market, so it came with no provenance. And so, in order for me to do anything with it analytically, there's then a whole. And I'm never going to know for certain where this thing came from, but I can locate it pretty. I can do a pretty clear materials test on it. It's in extremely good condition, so that there's a sense of it having been probably not actually that all intensely used. It's bendable, but if you drop them, they break. So and they chip. So it's been in pretty good circumstances. But yeah, so you would want to look at catalogs to get a sense of dating, of price, and illustrations and paintings and all forms of visual materials to get a sense of how it's being used, who it's being used by, all of those kinds of, so to locate it in time and space, and over time and space. So you can get a sense of when does this shape come in, when does it go out. The other thing is that if you have this sticking out of your head, then you're not doing much energetic labor, even in a serious chignon. So you can read from these things into what kind of gestures are possible for somebody wearing these. Yeah?
Is it something that would have been...
I'm Joelle Newlander. I'm from the Citadel. And is it something that would have been, I don't know, the way the form is in the back, it looks like something Japanese, you know?
Yeah, is it is almost certainly French in production, but it is influenced by a Japanese aesthetic. Absolutely.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah. And you can also, and part of how it's easy to trace that is because of the presence, I mean, what we know about Japanese, and also the presence in a variety of kinds of documents of Japanese combs that are of a similar shape. How about this guy? This has a hinge. It's got, it's in somewhat less good condition. It's got a broken pick on it. The little beads are coral, and it's hinged. Probably not, because it's very fragile. The hinge is brass. Any guess as to how that would be worn, or again, what you would derive, how you would find out about it is pretty much the same as from the other routine. But why the hinge? Yeah, actually, you can. Yeah. Yep.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, cool.
Yeah,
that it's. Yeah, though it's actually holding the bun more than the other one. So it would sit at the side and follow your head. And coral is obviously a maritime material that, like the tortoise shell, so that relatively precious one. So the carriage, this has a, even though it's more delicate, more fragile, it actually limits your behavior much less than the other one. Because of how it's sitting on your head. So one would read off of that. And just my last one. This one is designed... this is a fake. I mean, it's kind of a fake. It's not really a fake. Any guess of period, just looking at the aesthetics? Yeah. It's 1920s, and it's fake ivory. It's plastic. With a little kind of jet decor. It's a 20s form that's picking up an 1830s form actually because it's got this little, and so it's an Art Deco that's playing on a 19th century vision in a form that was actually not expensive but designed to look as if it were. So again, that gives you, you know, one can spin this. I don't want to spend too long on these, but you can spin that out before you even get into this whole. Array of things that are actually used to comb the hair, and so on and so forth. So there's a whole range of personal accoutrements, basically the things used for as fashion accessories, but also as grooming, that you can take on to get a sense of the construction of self, and that might nuance or complicate what one thinks about otherwise. That's just one kind of class. So you can start, as I said at the beginning, one can start with the object. You know, you encounter something, and you're trying to figure it out, and you move from that to your historical question. Or you can start with the historical question. And the classic, some of you have seen this stuff before, but, you know, that the whole issue of how... how the diffusion of politics and political discipline in the French Revolution worked is something, is a classic historical problem, and that you can certainly approach through texts. So then the question, but then you can, as you're thinking about that, you look around and discover, you know, this is a fan with the costumes designed for all of the officials within the revolutionary process. Well, I'll show you a few others so you get the class. These are all in the Musée Carnavalet in Paris. So that's, you know, that's a pedagogic watch to, and then you can't read this, but it's Viva. What is it? I can't even read it anymore. Vivre libre ou mourir. On the inkwell. Your breakfast with guillotine. a valance for your house. That one is not from the Carnavalet. Okay. Oh, I don't have. Oh, but they were the earrings. I have to come back. We saw them later. I have them on. Yes, right. As if there are some fans. These are little guillotine earrings. And these are a set of playing cards. These I can circulate. They have been produced, you know, reproduced. One might note that the guillotines have little friggin' hats on top, and then the guillotine, and then a little head is the dongle. That's a head. Upside down, that's the hair, and the chin isn't up. So what do you learn? I mean, do you learn anything new and interesting about the French Revolution from these things, or is this just kind of nonsensical junk? I think you need a mic and...
Yeah, so it's on already.
Yeah, I'm John Monroe from Iowa State, and the earrings I've actually found really useful because you can ask, you know, everyone immediately thinks they're totally macabre, yeah. And you say, oh, well, they're actually a status item, right? In the you know, that Thermidorian period, and you to have the students sort of work out why they are, like, why would a woman have them made? Mm-hmm. And wear them with pride, mm-hmm. right at that moment. And it's actually a really useful question to have the students ask through the earrings.
Right, yeah. So that, the very bizarreness of them in a certain way pedagogically is incredibly useful.
Yeah.
The earrings are, of course, the most, you know, effective that way. But just to go back to the others, even the things that are less kind of aggressively bizarre... what would you teach? This is a pocket watch. I'm sorry, you don't get the curse of slides. You don't get the scale, and it's bright. It's a porcelain face. That's now it's not porcelain. It's an enameled face. It's very bright. So, what does one learn from that?
Well, it would have been very expensive to make the watch.
Yeah,
because it's really complicated, right?
Yeah.
So that's a pretty high status item.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it's got the 12-hour face and the 10-hour face. And so the whole question, it makes it really clear that moving to a 10-hour, you know, that there was a sense that there was a need to learn the transition from one system to the next. That it wasn't simply by decree that you get people to move from one everyday system to another everyday system, but it has to be inculcated through practice. And preferably through embodied practice. So every time, you know, anybody's written with a quill pen, you take off, these are two different inks, and you have to dip it, and you write, and you dip it, and you write. And each time you dip it, you know, you see this slogan. So the idea, it's telling you that that at least a set of people engaged in the revolution thought that there was a need for a very particular kind of embodied pedagogy for the political message to change. Or not the message, for people's political habitus to change. Yeah, Erica? Yeah.
I guess I would want to know more about the pocket watch and how many were made, because it seems like there's a difference between saying, well, they made them in volume because they thought everybody needed to make this, versus saying, well, the people who were doing
business deals with people from other countries needed to be able to have a good time sense, but most people
didn't need.
Right. Yeah, and in fact, I know, absolutely, one wants to know much more about all of these things, both quantities of production, dates of production. Some of them are, there's been an argument about how many of them were, in fact, souvenirs and that were produced after, you know, in fact, well, beyond the revolutionary period, how many of them were produced in large numbers. This is a particular, I mean, about the watch, ones of that quality were indeed expensive and not common. There are lots of others that have the dual face, but aren't nearly as beautiful. And so they're still expensive because you have to make two mechanisms. But there was actually a broad diffusion of them. As there was of the ink. Well, some of these things we don't know how many there, you know, that is, it's just a problem. It's one of the difficulties of this kind of material is that you don't know that much. One of the other things that's really important is to figure out which stuff and how it's being mandated. Because, in the question of material culture of the French Revolution, there are endless texts mandating or advocating the production of a whole array of objects, and then there's silence on some other ones. And some of the objects that are about which there's silence were in fact produced in substantial quantities; some were not produced. So that whole, if you take these things in isolation and without all kinds of contextualization, you get yourself into serious trouble, I think. Yeah.
When did catalogs start?
18th century. I mean, it depends for what. But there are some
farm implements or something. Or are there?
No, 18th century is fashion. I mean, they're not exactly catalogs. They're fashion books and fashion dolls and yeah. And there are some kinds of catalogs for pharmaceuticals. I mean, there's shipping. There's information about commercial wares in the 18th century. And then the kind of what one thinks of as a kind of elaborated catalog as a 19th century thing. So I would argue in terms of the French Revolution, just thinking about this, if you're facing a skeptic who says, you know, why bother, given that it is fairly labor-intensive using these things to elaborate enough knowledge so that they're not using them irresponsibly. But I would say that it is crucial if you want to get at the whole how the historical actors were conceptualizing the process of change, of political change, and that it will be different than read. And part of it is, and this is that, And much more effectively if the historian actually encounters the objects than sees them on a screen, that you get a different sense by handling them. I mean, and then this is a point to which I'm very attached, which is enormously controversial among historians and people who work with this, which is I think that there is that there is something human about embodiedness that transcends time. And so that one learns something by handling an object that was made in the 18th century that is different from seeing it on a screen, different from other seeing in a drawing even of the time, and that there is, but one can argue about that. I don't think you have to take that position in order to find this stuff useful. Any other thoughts about the revolution? Yeah. It's on, I think.
Okay. Sorry. Clyde Plimosi, Université La Sorbonne. You could also do an entrepreneur history, how people marketed the French Revolution through those objects.
Yes.
Because when you saw buttons, for instance, during the French Revolution, or Pierre Palois, who sold Bastille stones to everyone at the time, you can see that also they use the French Revolution as a marketing strategy.
Yeah.
And so there are the pedagogical side, but also the marketing one that is pretty powerful during the French Revolution, I think. Maybe not with this beautiful object, but with other objects.
Yeah, although even there, the question of whether, and there are some people who say that it's only a marketing strategy, that an argument that there is any political meaning to this is romanticism, and that's an argument. I mean, that's an argument that I think is not resolvable empirically. I think it's a position. Yeah, I mean, I think I agree entirely that was part of what was going on. My own stance is that was part of what was going on, and that there was also a real engagement, a conviction in the, not shared by everyone, but that there was an embodiedness to politics But that's ultimately a theoretical argument, I think, and a theoretical and to some extent historical when one reads other texts from the period talking about how politics work. And you know and 18th century sensationalism. It's logical that they actually thought these things would accomplish something. But one can but it's an important and the argument is an important argument. There were other people who yeah.
Just to keep this straight. Who's got six and who got seven? Okay, got six.
So I just had a question about the embodiedness. I agree with you completely about the value of touching, handling an object. You can learn a lot from it. So this summer I got a chance to do this, and I worked through the 20 questions to ask an object. But the problem that I find, and I'm thinking a lot of people who work on 18th or earlier 18th century or earlier things is it's really hard to touch the objects because usually they're locked away, they're in cabinets, they're behind glass. If you, I was fortunate enough to be a fellow at a museum, and I was invited there in part to work with the objects. But then when I said, "Can I want to touch them?" They're sort of like, "Ooh, maybe not," you know. Right. And one curator said, "You really need to touch the objects, handle them, ask questions of them, the 20 questions." And then the next day, a different curator said, "No, we don't want you to do that." So I was able to finally get a few to handle,
right.
And it was amazing. And I did learn a lot.
Yeah.
But we've got this barrier.
Yeah, it is, and there's and one of the really interesting discussions is between rare books bibliographers and museum people, because the book people are willing to let people handle things, and museum people are not. And some of it's insurance. I mean, there's a cultural difference that comes in part from insurance. Talk about pragmatic questions, but yeah, but it is still at least better to have it, you know, to look at than to see it there. I mean, in terms of getting a sense of its tangibility. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Denise Davidson. I teach at Georgia State University. So I have a related question about this issue of having objects to see and to touch. And it's also connected back. I wanted to bring this up before we move too far away from the objects that touch the body discussion, just before we went into the revolutionary stuff. So I've been working for a long time on a project using letters exchanged between members of a couple interrelated bourgeois families in the very first couple decades of the 19th century. And I'm beginning work now on a chapter focused on material culture where they discuss objects, furniture, and so on. And one of the things that I've noticed that is a very common practice apparently in the period, I'd never been aware of it, I need to do more research on it, is whenever a girl in the family gets married, one of the gifts they always gave them, there's lots of discussion of gifts, so a lot of my interest now is thinking about using objects as gifts and what that all means and how it connects to, anyway, building networks and connecting families and so on. But one of those objects that gets mentioned all the time in the context of gifts given at the time of a marriage, of a wedding, is a comb with diamonds in it.
Mm.
And so, again, I need to do more research and see if we have any, you know, literature on those particular kinds of gifts and those particular objects. But it gets back to this issue of touching them. I have never seen a comb of the sort that they seem to be discussing in their letters. I will certainly not touch one. Okay. And so I'm wondering what you think of being able to use texts to talk about objects.
Yeah, no, it's a really, really important question, and this is a completely different kind of text, but just to jump, since I have that's just one example. These are restitution. This is restitution documentation from the Second World War, and so where there are, you know, lists of things and objects turned into text, and I think that they're. And it's essential to do that. I mean, because so often one doesn't have the thing, and the things have either been destroyed, been lost, or you can't get access. And to say, well, I'm only going to work on things if I actually have the thing, seems to me too limiting. On the other hand, it should be possible in that instance to get. I mean, you're not going to see that comb, but to find it, it's almost certainly a comb of, you know, this kind of genre, and not the comb of the combing hair genre. And so. To locate something that's, you know, from the period that's within the same class of object, and to extrapolate as closely as one can within the limits of the possible. And I'm a pragmatist, I guess, on that. While admitting the limits of what one's doing, but, you know, not saying it's not the thing, but also something I've gotten more and more interested in is working through the relationship between the description and the object, that is, paying attention to its transformation into prose and taking advantage of that. So it's better to have an object and a description or a discussion of an object than only one or the other. But the text, the words and the things work together, I think, in powerful ways. I mean, so another kind of example of that. Which way am I? Is it this way? Yeah. This is a colonial example where these are these guys called the sapeurs who are in Belgian Congo and French Congo and later in Paris. And in this case, there's an object, the clothes that they're wearing, a very distinctive style of clothing. There's also a whole discourse around the clothes. The practice is a combination of the naming. So these guys, it's incredibly important that they know what brands the stuff that they're wearing is for the practice. And so there's a dialectic process between the wearing of the thing, the naming of the thing, and the knowledge inherent in it, in both elements. So, yeah, it's not a very satisfactory answer entirely, but I think that I would be amazed if hunting through decorative arts museums and costume museums, you couldn't find something that was close enough to be able to extrapolate from and get the sense. And what other? And it's interesting, in that case, it would be a comb and not something else that would be the object. There was somebody else who wanted to say something.